and exploring light together. For those just arriving, I think you probably know we're having a transmission of light celebration, Sesshin, exploring these ancient stories of our Zen ancestors. One after another, passing on this appreciation of light. And yesterday we raised the story of Qingyuan, Seigen Gyoshi, and his student is named Shirto. Sekito Kisen, who quite wonderfully, we got to chant his classic poem this morning, The Merging of Difference and Unity. So partly because of that, he's one of our favorite Zen ancestors. He wrote The Merging of Difference and Unity, and he wrote The Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage, some of you may know. And we explored some of these stories about his life. I'm recalling last summer at Jikoji, we had a session on the merging of difference and unity. So these stories are maybe familiar from that time. Again, these are stories collected by our ancestor Keizan Jokin. And he tells the story and then he comments on, and he also tells a little bit about the life of each of these ancestors. The 35th ancestor, Great Master Wu Qi. Often they have these, you know, multiple different names. He's Shirto Shichen, but here he's called Wu Qi. Wu Qi means no boundary. That might be a posthumous name. They often, after they die, some of these great teachers receive another name. And Shirto means, or Sekito means, we could say stone head, but maybe more accurately and appropriately, on top of the stone, at the head of the stone, on top of the stone, because, as his story mentions here, he liked to sit on top of a stone. I think Shijian means something like rare transformation. So the 35th ancestor, Wu Qi, no boundary, visited Qingyuan, who is that one we heard yesterday, didn't even practice the Four Noble Truths. And thus, didn't fall into any particular stages where he might have gotten stuck. Also, I mentioned yesterday's story. I tend to, these days, sometimes see stories and situations through this lens of these three turnings of the Dharma wheel, which many of you have heard again and again. And I think this story expresses that again, and I'm starting to have the feeling, I thought before but not in these words, that Keizan himself is a real third turning kind of guy. And we can explore that as we go through these stories, but I think this story could be seen in this particular way. Maybe just I'll briefly mention before you hear the story so you can see if you think so. The first turning of the Dharma wheel is, for example, the Four Noble Truths, and there's myriad dharmas that make up what we call me, for example. But we can't actually find some independent me other than all these myriad phenomena. It's kind of like the first turning of the Dharma wheel. And the second turning of the Dharma wheel is all these myriad phenomena that we find instead of me. We can't find them either, as the Heart Sutra says so clearly. There's actually no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, and so on. Prajnaparamita is usually said to be the second turning of the Dharma wheel. And the third turning is spoken of in different ways. You can read further elaborations in the current newsletter. But in this case, it's, how can you go beyond no eye, no ear, no nose, unfindability of everything? Well, the third turning is about going beyond, or another, something more, offering something more than just the negation of everything. And sometimes that's expressed as Buddha nature. Buddha nature is not nothing, not merely no eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. It is no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, and yet it's not just left there. It's also, at the very same time, this bright, clear awareness. I think yesterday's story where Keizan actually mentions Buddha nature, and he says, for example, look carefully, this bright, empty realm, so it's empty, but it's bright. It's that inconceivable union of brightness and emptiness. And this bright, empty realm, or this bright, empty realm, is brighter than the rising sun. Even though this vast, marvelous, true nature is not an object of discrimination, it possesses complete, perfect, clear understanding. Though it's not bound by bones and marrow, it has a bright body that's not covered or hidden. That was in yesterday's commentary. And we find this kind of expression very regularly throughout this transmission of light. Treatise of Keizan. In Dogen's teaching we find it too sometimes, but it's not the main thing that Dogen's emphasizing. So it's a little step after Dogen that's being emphasized here by Keizan. So if you have some sense of how the third turning of the Dharma wheel now is offering something more than just complete negation. Bright, clear awareness, right here and now, always just shining. And, at the risk of oversimplification, transmission of light, that this book is called, could be said to be this very empty clarity. So, back to the story. 35th ancestor, Wu Qi Shirto Qian, visited Qing Yuan, and Qing Yuan asked, as often these conversations start, "Where are you from?" And the master, meaning the ancestor of this present story, Shirto, replied, "I come from Cao Qi." Remember, Cao Qi is the home of the sixth ancestor, Huainong. Cao Creek was just happened to be the name of the creek that flowed through that temple. And this, by the way, is the Cao of Cao Dong school, the Soto. Cao Qi in Japanese is Sokei. So our family tradition here is the Cao Qi tradition combined with the Dongshan tradition. So Cao Dong or Soto. So this is still in the time when the six ancestors living, and something very cool was happening there, it looks like, in the south of China. The teaching of immediacy and Buddha as this very life was being brought up in a very kind of controversial and disturbing way to some people, and quite exuberant and joyful way to others. So remember, Qingyuan is actually a disciple of the sixth ancestor, Cao Qi. So when Shirto comes to Qingyuan, he says, "Where are you from?" And Shirto says, "I come from Cao Qi." In other words, "I come from your teacher's place. And I brought a prop for this story here." Qingyuan raised his whisk. It's called a hosu. It's a fly whisk. So when flies and mosquitoes land on you, you don't have to kill them. You can just go like that. So they always seem to carry these things at that time. So Qingyuan raised the whisk, and also this was a thing that they would do, is they would raise the whisk, and I mean, we can talk about what this is if you like, but it's hard to say. But it's raised to express and sometimes it's put down to express not this. So in this case, the ancestor Qingyuan raised the whisk and asked, "Does this exist at Cao Qi?" Shirto answered, "It's not only non-existent at Cao Qi, but it doesn't exist in India either." Qingyuan, or Shirto, I should say, Shirto had heard and chanted many times, "There's no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, and therefore those things don't exist at Cao Qi, the sixth ancestor's place." In India represents Buddha, right? So not only does it not exist in this sixth ancestor's place, Buddha doesn't even have this. This doesn't exist in India either. How could it? I mean, try to find this in India. This. does this exist at Tsao Chi? It's not only non-existent at Tsao Chi, but it doesn't exist in India either. Shirto was a second turning kind of guy, and he's about to meet a third turner. Qin Yuan asked him, "You haven't been to India yet, have you?" In other words, how would you, are you just saying that? Or have you been there to know that it's not there? Have you met the Buddha? The master said, "If I went there, it would exist there." Or, "If I went to India, if I went to India, then it would exist in India." But, of course, I haven't been to India. I haven't seen the Buddha. No one's seen the Buddha. And therefore, how could it exist? "You haven't been to India yet, have you?" Qin Yuan said, Shirto said, "If I went, it would exist." Qin Yuan said, "That's not good enough. Say more. Don't stop at the second turning of the Dharma wheel. It's not the whole story. The Buddha's full expression has not been revealed yet in our conversation." From the point of view of the second turning, there's nothing left to express. It's not only not in Tsao Chi, it's not in India, and obviously I haven't been there. If I had been there, or if I was here right now, then it would exist and everything else would too. But that's not good enough. Say more. And then Shuto says, "Master, you should say half of it and not depend completely on me." We could say, is he actually starting to feel a little pushed here? And like, I'm being like, I've expressed it all. What else can be said? If I went, it would exist. That's not good enough. I've already said a lot. I've already like turned the first and second Dharma wheels. So, Master, you say something now, please. Maybe you have that feeling sometimes. Yeah. Where we get kind of like we reach the limit of our own understanding and we feel like, help. Or another take on this would just be, let's not have this be one-sided. Let's together express this. Let's together bring out this this complete Dharma. But if that's the case, Qin Yuan doesn't want to go with that interpretation, because he says, "I don't refuse to speak to you, but I'm afraid that after this, no one will be deeply awakened." Or another translation is, if I speak to you, in the future, no one will get it. In other words, there's some interesting dynamic here about mutually bringing forward the Dharma and helping each other, and yet we're totally independent. There's nobody else to rely on, ultimately. We have to do this work on our own. "I don't refuse to speak to you, but I'm afraid that after this, no one will be deeply awakened." Like, if I explain this for you, then you'll be temporarily satisfied and there'll be a nice, neat ending of the story, and we can go home. But you've been making this great effort to respond to me like this, so just a little more. One more moment of exertion or complete diligence, zeal. Not good enough, quite. Say more. So I'm afraid that after this, no one will be deeply awakened if I speak to you. And Qingyuan said, Shirto said, it's not that no one will be awakened, it's just that no one will be able to express it. So he kind of contradicts this. You know, whether you say anything or not now, it's not that no one will be awakened, it's not that no one will get it. Actually, you said no one will get it, but it's not that no one will get it. But it's just that no one will be able to express it. It kind of breaks these into, you know, people can get it, but they just won't be able to express it from them, from their own heart. And this term expression here is, in Japanese, dotoku, which is, I know, one of Kathy's, Kathy has a kind of intimate connection with this fascicle of Dogen called dotoku, or expression. So it comes up here, and I looked for it in his fascicle, but he doesn't bring up this story. But that's the term. It's not that no one will be awakened, and not that no one will get it, it's just that no one will be able to express it. So this issue of expression is very important in our lineage, according to Dogen and this story. It's not that no one will be awakened, it's just that no one will be able to express it. Qingyuan then hit him with the whisk, and Shirto was greatly awakened. That's the story. Before we get into the details of this, just to get to know Shirto a little bit first. His name was Shi Qian, and he was from the Qian family of Gao An and Tuan Zhou. Places are always important in these old records. Exactly where people lived. They always lived in a particular place. Yeah, they were particular people who expressed their lives in particular ways. After his mother became pregnant, she took no pleasure in strong-smelling vegetables or food that was meat-like. So, maybe she felt like, you hear the old kind of stories, right? She didn't like to eat onions or meat because there was this pure being of some kind, right, inside her, is the implication. Even as an infant, he did not trouble his nurse. Even when he was young, he had a lot of self-confidence. Hunters in his native place were afraid of demons and spirits, and many offered sacrifices to appease the spirits. It was their practice to slaughter oxen and offer wine libations. The master went there and demolished their shrine and freed the oxen. This occurred more than 10 times a year, and the village elders could not make him stop. So, I see Shirto as one of the first animal rights activists. They were making these animal sacrifices, and he just, as a kid, he couldn't stand to see that. Partly because he thought, well, this is not valuable spiritual practice, and like lives don't need to be lost for this. You still have this issue actually in India, because there's various Hindu rituals that involve these like total blood fests. I went to this place actually in Kathmandu where there was just, you know, pools of blood where these animals are being offered to Kali. Kali is like the great black wrathful Dharma being, the great mother goddess. And so they do all these animal sacrifices, and then there's these Buddhists alongside, like, what are you doing? Animal sacrifice, strange thing. It's been going on, I think, a very long time in this world. But he was a very practical guy, and he did this. I myself was an animal rights activist in college, and when I got to Tassajara, there were these, as you know, there's all these flies in the summer, right? There's like tons of flies, and they particularly like in the dish shack, we call it, the dishwashing room, there's flies like all over the place because there's all this old food and compost and stuff. And they hang, you know, the sticky fly paper in the kitchen and stuff too. And I'm like, do we really have to do that? And like, it's a health issue here. There are flies all over the food. I mean, they're all over the food anyway. But it maybe stops a few of them. And in the dish shack, they had like, you know, line up all along the wall, these fly swatters. In my like maybe first years there, coming from this background of like really wanting animals to be free and happy, down to flies, I would sneak into this dish shack at night, and I'd take all the fly swatters and twist them into knots and put them in the trash. And maybe this wasn't so appropriate because it's actually stealing from the Sangha. But I did not feel guilty. I felt happy about doing this. It was strange. I don't know if I would do this these days, but at the time I felt like... And they would just buy more, right? And then I'd pick them up and put them back. I'm like, well, it's some flies' lives are saved. Anyway, when Shurto was 13, he went to Sauchi. They started young, right, in these days. He became a novice monk at 13, but did not receive the complete precepts. The sixth ancestor was about to die, and Shurto asked him, after you die, if I'm still uncertain, on whom should I rely? If we could tell from the different ancestors here that the sixth ancestor was probably quite old when 13-year-old Shurto came. So you might not live so much longer after you die. If I'm still uncertain, who should I rely on? What teacher should I practice with? The ancestor answered, something that sounded like, go and think about it. Kind of weird answer. Turns out this was later a misinterpretation. When the ancestor died, the master Shurto would sit in meditation in a quiet place, so still it seemed as if he were dead. The senior monk Nanyue asked him, your master has died, why are you sitting for no reason? The master replied, I received his final instructions, so I am investigating. He said, go think about it, so that's what I'm doing. And Nanyue said, you have an elder Dharma brother named Shingsu, who now lives at Mount Qingyuan. That's where you have an affinity. The ancestor's words were extremely unambiguous. You just deluded yourself by thinking he had said, go and think, which in Chinese is zi. Well, he really said, go to zi, meaning xing zi. Can you follow that? And it's kind of like how Chinese and Japanese is, there's only so many sounds, so it's very easy to misinterpret in the spoken language. If they just say, go to su, and you might go to that person, or go and think. And Nanyue kind of harshly says, these words were extremely unambiguous. How could you have interpreted like that? So, if that was the case, that's an interesting, I think, that an interesting practice to go to the teacher before dying and say, who should I practice with afterwards? And then maybe there's some connection between those. I mean, this was actually his student, right? Sixth ancestor's student was Jingyuan, so let's go practice with my student, Jingyuan. When I went to Japan to practice with another teacher, I had a letter from my teacher that said to Tongen Harada Roshi, you know, this is my student Kokyo, please, you know, take care of him and train him well. And so my first Dokusan there, I gave that letter to him through the translator there, because he didn't speak English, and she read it to him. And I don't know how it would have been different if he hadn't had that kind of recommendation. If in other words, if I wasn't sent by my teacher to go practice with him, but he took that as like, this person's not just coming on their own. His teacher, who I don't know and will never meet, is asking me to train him. So he immediately pulled out his, you know, the little kyosaku, which is the stick, the wake-up stick. It has this little one right in front. And just immediately upon reading that, just whack on the thigh. I'm like, wow, we don't do that in America.
Your thigh?
Yeah. So I felt like, after the shock, I felt happy that something got passed, some request came from my teacher to that teacher. And I bowed at the end of Dokusan. He whack on the back as I was bent over. He was a very compassionate, loving teacher, I truly feel. And I think it's very rare to find, I have rarely come across teachers who are very fierce, but I really feel like there's no self thing going on behind it. It's not about them at all. They're not on some kind of power trip. They're not like trying to, be harsh or scolding. I felt like this person just like emanated love, but it got expressed in these ways. I mean, it took me time practicing with him to feel that. There was a time when we took turns. Koji practiced there a little bit, right? Very short time at Bukokuji. There was a time when we would take turns each period being like the Do-on. Every period of Zazen, the Do-on would switch, but it was called the Junko or something else, because the Do-on also carried the Kyosaku, the stick for the assembly. So you basically ring the bell to start the period. You take Manjushri's sword from the altar and you patrol the Zendo for that period, and you put it down at the end, ring the bell, and you pass a little plaque to the next person. It just rotates around the room each period. And but my turn, maybe I hadn't been there that long, or maybe I had, but at any rate, and there's a clock in the Zendo, which is kind of unusual too. You're using this clock and to time the period. So, and I was confused. as to when the period ended. So, and I was kind of oblivious of time, I guess, because it just kept going. I just kept walking my rounds around the Zendo, and you'd go out into the Gaitan under area and back in, these very slow, like you're almost like Kinhin, walking around. And people started like the head monk started going, psst, pah, and they're kind of like making these faces at me, like, I'm like, huh? And I look at him and they're like, I'm like, what's going on? And I just keep walking. And more and more people started like turning. And I guess it had been like, you know, a long time. They were usually 40-minute periods, but this was like an hour or something. And I'm like, what's going on? Something strange is happening here, but I feel like very disconcerted because I have no idea what. Like, it wasn't even a question of what, of whether I was wrong the reading the time. And then I finally realized, I looked at the clock, and like, it does seem like it's been a while. Like, oh no! I thought to myself, it's like 20 minutes later, just, you know. So I quickly, you know, put down the stick, rang the bell, and people were like, and the abbot, Tongan Roshi, you know, on the way out of the room, he kind of grabbed, and he's this old guy, like in his 80s, right? Little old guy. He kind of like grabbed my head and like put it in here, and it's, I think, what we now call a noogie. And then he left, and I was like, whoa. And people said, oh, you're so lucky you got a, like, you know, a love noogie from the master. So, I don't know if I should, you know, this is a diversion, so I won't get into all the love stories too, but I felt like it was his heart. These things were about, you know, pay attention, be awake right now, this is it. Like, please wake up to your life. That was the kind of like strict feeling about it. Very kind person. So, Shuto went to pay reverence at the shrine for the sixth ancestor and his deceased teacher, and at once left for Mount Jingyuan. And Jingyuan said that when he got there, he said, there are people who say something is happening in Lingnan. And apparently Lingnan was a Zen phrase for like south of the mountain, meaning like the southern Zen that was starting at Shaoqi, where this new teaching of immediacy was being offered. So Qingyuan says to young Shuto, there are people who say something's happening in Lingnan. And Shuto says, there are people who do not say that something is happening in Lingnan. He's a second turning guy. There are people who say that something's happening down there in the south. And he replies, there are people who do not say that something is happening down there in the south. And Qingyuan says, well, if that is so, where do all the teachings of the Mahayana and the Hinayana come from? You know, if there's nothing happening, where did all this Dharma come from? And Shuto said, they are holy from here. So he's got a little third turning in him too. Qingyuan affirmed this as correct, and after that they often engaged in question and answer discussions. Once, this is now Keizan's commentary, once Qingyuan raised the whisk and said, does this exist at Shaoqi? What is it? when my teacher gave me this thing late one night, he said, please take care of it and don't let it be cut off in the future. When Qingyan raised the whisk and said, does this exist at Cao Qi? Shuto said, it's not only non-existent at Cao Qi, but it doesn't exist in India either. Keizan says, in past and present, they have raised the whisk to demonstrate some principle, to instigate action, to make people depart from the crooked path, or to make people point directly to true reality without delay. That's one thing they use that for. Qingyuan also raised the whisk as a test. However, Shuto did not yet understand what this is. Still fixing his gaze on the raised whisk, he said, not only is it non-existent at Cao Qi, but it doesn't exist in India either. Keizan says, when this whisk is raised, how can you say that there's either a Cao Qi or an India? So he's agreeing. When this is raised, how can you really say that this exists at Cao Qi or India? How can you say that there is Cao Qi or India? How can you actually say anything exists? It's true. Yet, this view is still only a verbal understanding of something external. He's kind of saying, he was just talking about emptiness teachings he'd heard. Therefore, Qingyuan pressed him, asking, you haven't been to India yet, have you? In other words, are you just saying this, or have you been to that place where nothing exists? But Shuto did still not understand these words. Unable to forget himself, he said, if I went, it would exist. Even though he could say this, if he didn't know that it exists, he would not be the right person, or he would not be a suitable ancestor, we could say. Even though he could say this, if he didn't know that it exists, Qingyuan spoke again, saying, not good enough, say more. He was being kindly and compassionate, dripping mud and water, and thus he spoke fully in this way. In our family style, we have so many strange images. So, right, compassionate, kind of like overly compassionate help, because Zen has some also reputation for kind of aloofness. And, for example, if I were to say something, people won't get it in the future. It's not exactly aloofness, but it's, please don't make me explain everything. You come forward. So, dripping mud and water. This is Zen image for this compassionate coming forth. And you could say that that's like, it's kind of like getting muddy. Getting muddy is like explaining Zen a lot. But we're totally willing to. That's compassion. We're willing to get that muddy and dripping mud and water. And this is, quite strict in the sense that just to say not good enough, say more, is this very compassionate mud dripping response. Here, Shuto had no chance to speak appropriately. He said, Master, you should say half of it and not depend completely on me. Meeting in this way, and this is Keizan now, meeting in this way and speaking in this way, if each just communicates a half, how can the whole thing be expressed? This is, I think, an interesting principle here about each one completely expressing oneself on one's own in a way, but knowing that no one's on one's own ever. We're completely supporting each other, completely intimately connected beyond any possibility of any separation, and yet the expression comes forth, each one's own. If each just communicates a half, how can the whole thing be expressed? Even if heaven and earth collapsed and the entirety was revealed alone, this would still be going halfway. This place is still reached by oneself, not borrowing someone else's resources. How much less can you inform someone else by continuing to go halfway when you're trying to communicate intimate words and absolutely not depend on someone else? We have interdependence as one of our really basic fundamental teachings. We always rely on everybody and everything. We're completely interdependent. And we also have independence, that each person, each thing abiding in its Dharma position. We say in its interdependent Dharma position that's created by everything else. But in that very unique position, each thing completely expresses itself independently, while at the same time completely dependently. On the contrary, you can only experience fundamental true self alone. Therefore, Qingyuan said, "I don't refuse to speak to you, but I'm afraid that after this, no one will get it." Even if someone speaks of pain or speaks of bitterness, if that person doesn't experience pain deep in his bones or experience bitterness ripping apart his tongue, he ultimately cannot understand the reality of it. You cannot get to it through words. We could say the same thing about happiness, but Geizan brings up, you know, pain. You can, and our practice is to really try to open to others' pain. Really, that's what compassion is. Open to coming as close as we can to experiencing others' pain. And yet, in the end, we can't really experience anybody's experience exactly. So it's like each person's present mind, only they can experience that particular unique version in their Dharma position. Because this is the way it is, spiritual teachers do not use words indiscriminately or do things pointlessly, thus protecting the principle of self-effort. That's in parentheses, protecting the principle of self-effort, so that might be the translator's addition there. But seems to be the point. However, still thinking that true reality was not the same as the whisk, and not knowing deep inside that there was a passageway, Shurto did not see it fully. He said, "It's not that no one will be deeply awakened, not that no one will get it, but no one will be able to express it." And this is an interesting comment now from Keizan. He says, "I'm afraid that this is what Shurto said. But when a person reaches this realm, how can he not have something to express?" He's kind of calling him and like, well, how could you get it but not be able to express it? Because in Keizan's understanding, and I think Dogen's too, in Dotoku, it's like, by being in touch with this, by appreciating the light, expression naturally comes forth. It can't be hindered. When a person reaches this realm, how can he not have something to express? If she reaches this realm, what can she have? Shirto sought externally and separated himself from inner realization for no reason. In order to make him realize at once the existence of such a thing, and in order to make him realize at once the existence of his original head, Ching Yuan struck him with the whisk, whacking the grass and scaring away the snakes. Consequently, the master was greatly awakened. What are those snakes crawling through the grass that need to be scared away by whacking the grass? That prevent Shirto from realizing the existence of his original head, his stone head. Thank you, Patrick, for bringing the Shobogenzo to Wormjewel Temple. Dotoku expressions, Kazu Tanahashi translates Dotoku as expressions. You could say expression, but expressions, that one letter S, you know, can add a whole different flavor. For me, that letter S is like each one abiding in one's own Dharma position expresses in a completely different and particular way. All Buddhas and ancestors are expression, Dotoku. Thus, when Buddha ancestors intend to select Buddha ancestors, they always ask, "Do you have your expression?" This question is asked with the mind and with the body. It's asked with a walking stick or a whisk. It's asked with a pillar or a lantern. Those who are not Buddha ancestors do not ask this and do not answer this, since they're not in the position to do so. Such an expression is not obtained by following others or by the power of oneself. Where there is a thorough inquiry of Buddhas and ancestors, there is an expression of Buddhas and ancestors. Expression is not obtained by following others or by the power of oneself. So how could it be that that it's not that they don't get it, it's just they won't be able to express it? How could such a thing be? Kazan asks. Let's open the floor, open the ceiling for expression and conversation or questions about this story thus far.
In studying Dotoku, one of the translations, I don't remember where it is, was the ability to express. That was the breaking apart of Dr. And I don't know enough about the characters to know what would be what, but that I'm thinking about that in light of what you're sharing and reading and talking about, that, you know, we all have Buddha nature, but now there's some kind of consideration of, you know, can you express it? And, you know, that's essentially a very solitary question, because only you can express it, and only, you know, nobody can do it for you. So even though we have this wonderful collaborative, you know, environment and commitment to mutual support, ultimately, it's your own coming forth. And that's a big mystery, and often I think it's a source of anguish, but of joy as well.
Why anguish?
Well, you know, if you want to and you can't, or you feel thwarted, or you feel insufficient, you know, which can be a motivation for awakening, you know, because you keep it's some kind of motivation to keep trying. That would be the anguish. Or if you want another, you really feel the other, and yet you sense their suffering. You know, wanting to, you know, but you can't do it for another.
You can't pull an expression forth.
No, you can't. And yet we can do, I believe we can do whatever we can to try to create support for one another. And those are always my favorite stories, you know, when the bumbling Dharma companions help each other out.
And really, these stories, you know, often sound very exalted, and that's, I think, part of Kazan's intention is his job is establishing the authenticity of this lineage at this time, and it's very, as you spoke about yesterday, this was this beginning of Soto Zen in Japan, just a few generations into it. In a way, it was established, and then this is one commentator's view on how what the intention of the Denko Roku is. It's like the Zen was already, and Soto Zen also, already established for, you know, 100 years, maybe less, in Japan. But then his task, he felt like at this point, was to really clarify what it is. You know, it's such a new thing, and people were just exploring what it is and hearing all different stuff about it. So Kazen's like, okay, we've got, there's practice places, people are practicing, now we have to really make these subtle distinctions and clarify. Also, when you said, Kathy, we can't really pull an expression out of others, and yet, as Dogen says, where there is a thorough inquiry of a Buddha ancestor or a Buddha Zen ancestors, there is an expression of a Buddha ancestor. So the question is asked, by oneself, and the expression comes forth from that, but also just by questioning each other, gives us a chance to, gives the other a chance to express. And also when we hear about this, there's this whole Shobogenzo chapter called Expression, it might sound like, well, maybe we better not say anything because it might not be like expression. It might not be authentic enough or something. And I know I can feel that way. So I think we have to be careful not to get into like wrong, thinking that there's a wrong expression. I think it's just a matter of coming forth, because the light is continuously shining through us. The true person of no position is constantly going in and out the portals of our face, including our mouth. So from the kind of deepest perspective, expression is constantly arising and coming forth.
Well, and one of the things to Sagan, whose expression of the deepest Buddha Dharma was that what is the place of place?
You mean, yeah.
It's something. It's something more than eloquence that they were both talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's something about this. The price of rice in Lu Ling is a matter of this. And it's hard when we're asked something like, well, what's the ultimate meaning of Buddha Dharma? We might start, you know, searching through all our mind files, looking for the correct answer. But what Qingyuan just said, well, what is the price of rice in Lu Ling? He didn't have to search elsewhere for that immediate expression.
I'm wondering, are you referring simply to expressing understanding verbally? I can't help but think how people sometimes express understanding non-verbally, and sometimes it's very visible.
Definitely. It doesn't have to be verbal. Sometimes verbal just obscures. So that's why, since ancient times, people expressed this by just an action. And what was that Dotoku story?
Express the truth and I won't shave your head.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking. And isn't that it? He just held his head out?
Yeah.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so sometimes it comes in words and sometimes it doesn't come in words. And there's a way in which we can't avoid it, and yet there's a way in which we're called forth to take our Dharma position and be like exactly who we are in the most authentic way. And as Dogen says, Zen practice, something like, right? Zen practice is just like one continuous mistake. One mistake after mistake after mistake. And it's continuous practice and it's continuous expression. So, the realm where, I wish I hadn't said that. So, that was an expression, and like, I wish I hadn't said that is an expression. Feeling that is an expression. Saying to the person, I'm sorry I said that, is an expression. And like the more we can see it like that, and there is a way which it's all just fumbling along. We set up these, you know, a Zen hall, and we revere these ancient ancestors, and Keizan himself, right? In the last story that we left off at the last Benkoe Sesshin, I remember Keizan's admonitions. He would just looks like he was just ending one practice period with the story of Hui Neng. And so he's saying, Keizan says, for these 90 days this summer during the practice period, as we're closing now, you know, I've spoken of this and that, commenting on the past and present, and explaining the lives of the Buddhas and ancestors with wild and gentle words. I've gone into subtle and fine and treated you all like children and grandchildren, I think in a sons and daughters, family, and more, besmirching the Zen tradition and displaying our shame. So he kind of criticizes the assembly, but he criticizes himself for not more deeply investigating, now that our time is over. We've not completed our work and life is slipping away, so why wait until tomorrow? Summer is over and fall begins. Even if we've practiced well, the shame of our family is still exposed. So this is like our muddling along. We have to be careful with these things like shame, right? Because it's not like we're some kind of miserable failures, but it's more like we're so devoted to the way, let's just continue as wholeheartedly as we can, and with great humility. In the face of these ancestors who we didn't meet in person as such, and yet they've given us our lives. If Sher To didn't live and express Dharma in his particular way, quite literally, I often think this, right? Quite literally, this ancient story from long ago, we wouldn't be here right now sitting in this hall, because he's our ancestor that led up to Koban and Suzuki Roshi and so on. What would be different if Sher To didn't express himself the way he did? Something would be different in the world, but we'd have no idea. It could be amazing, and we'll never know. But in that way, that's one way to think about these ancestors, is for better or worse, here we are right now because of Sher To. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, and it's so ancient, and it's so similar. It looks like seems like, because we have these records of how they practiced all these minute details of a sesshin, for example, in ancient times, and we're doing pretty much most all of it, and just in a new language. So how very strange. The form hasn't changed so much. In some ways we could say it's changed a lot, and in other ways there's something that's very similar. And I think this is a very traditional Zen center, and there's problems, I think, with sticking too closely to a tradition, and there's problems with veering off from a tradition. So this is always our question.
Sitting is sitting.
Sitting is sitting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bottom line, sitting is sitting. Yes. Sitting is sitting, and maybe originally Chinyuan would have said, sitting isn't sitting. But if he said that, Shoto might have said, well, that's not enough, say more.
Sitting is sitting.
Sitting is sitting. First there is sitting, then there's no sitting, then there's sitting. Yes.
Are those stages? I have a comment and a question. My comment is, you mentioned asking, you know, the story of asking the teacher before he dies, mm-hmm. and I studied next, and I advise caution with that. I did it. Mm-hmm. And I got, I had a, quite a dialogue.
you just misunderstood. It was a bad translation.
Maybe. But anyway, her answer was, you're trying to replace me before I'm dead. And quite a deep conversation in and of itself. But my question is, I'm not sure I'm making the link that you're making between this story and turning the third dharma, or the third turning. Mm-hmm. So is what you're saying that his response, the questioner's response here was a second turning, meaning he was just saying, that's all there is. Negation is all there is.
It doesn't exist in Sauchi or India.
The teacher here is trying to elicit from him a response that includes, that would demonstrate that the light permeates everywhere?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, so more could be said, yeah. Particularly when I was thinking about this, it's like Buddha nature traditionally is inseparable from sentient beings, from living beings, but it's not really traditionally in India. It wasn't associated with like rocks, walls, tiles, and pebbles, and so on. They don't have Buddha nature. But as those teachings came from India to Sauchi, for example, it got bigger. It's like Buddha nature got vaster. And we may in the Sishin get up to Dungshan's story about the teaching of the insentient, where this becomes an issue. But this being, traditionally, this clear, bright awareness, that which we can't find, but yet clearly radiates everywhere, and then everything that's being irradiated by it, that's being illuminated by this awareness, is like infused with Buddha-ness, something like that. We could start to talk about how not just living beings, but the entire earth is an expression of Buddha nature. And I think there's something really dynamic there when this shift happens in the Zen tradition, and maybe pre-Zen, but it looks like it happens in China, including everything in this realm of Buddha nature, because, what's the relation? What is that world from the point of view of mind? Everything is experienced by mind. It's like if mind is creating the world, which often in Zen it is spoken that way, then this very mind is Buddha, then the world that this mind is creating is also like an expression of Buddha, or a manifestation of Buddha mind. So in the story, it's not actually talking about mind so much, right? It's like, does this exist? So this seems like from our normal point of view, like an object external to mind. But it seems like when this is being expressed here, it's about this dynamic workings of the whole world, and the Great Awakening about, you know, not, it doesn't exist there, but then, well, that wasn't nothing. And when I heard that answer, it reminded me of the story of Baijung's Wild Ducks. You know that one? Where Matsu and Baijung, his student, are walking along and some wild ducks fly by and Matsu, the teacher, kind of testing, says, what's that? And Baijung says, it's wild ducks. And Matsu says, well, where have they gone? Where have they flown off to? Or where have they gone? Baijung says, they've flown off. They're gone. No ducks. What are you talking about, teacher? Flown off. This is like, you know, Zen poetic way. Again, we could hear that as a negation. Where have they gone? They've flown off. No ducks. And then that great moment where Matsu reached out and twisted the nose of Baijung and said, where are they gone now? And at that, Baijung, while crying out in pain, had this great awakening. So I think the same principle as this story. Where have they gone? They've flown off. They're gone. Where have they gone now? Not in Saochi, not in India. That's not nothing, right? Immediate contact. This life feeling is happening. A nose is twisted. A physical nose, not no nose. Right? No nose doesn't hurt. But a physical nose gets, elicits a yelp. Not this. This not existing anywhere doesn't have an impact on one's head, but that is some, like, I felt it. And you know, words are a little bit off, because I felt it is not really what we're talking about. It's that it's not nothing. It's not nothing. Double negations are a great gift of language. It's not nothing. It's not that I'm not joyful. It's just like finding a jewel in this world of messy life. Please come in.
So my question for the, you know,
let's stop. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I don't save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. And Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.